now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
What an exciting show we have for people today, Dean Haglund.
Well, I can't wait, Phil Lairness. What makes it so exciting?
Well, we have a special guest, and a special guest who I think might turn the tables on us.
Oh.
He might have some questions for us because he's the host of his own show. He has... some very insightful and, kind of inspiring comments in the wake of the Orlando shootings of a couple weeks back.
Yeah.
And quite honestly, I need it. I need someone to have something inspiring. And
a lightning perspective?
Yes. Yes.
I hear that.
So, I don't know. Why don't we quit delaying and get right to welcoming our guest?
Fantastic. Let's do it.
Dean, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there used to be among some of our listeners a drinking game associated with Chilpack Hollywood Hour. Whenever I would say the word storyteller, you had to take a shot. So this episode is going to be really fun for the heavy drinking audience. Because I get to introduce the word right off the bat by saying that our guest today is, in fact, a storyteller, full stop. That is how he identifies himself. I know him as the host of a fantastic podcast called Getting Better Acquainted, on which I was a guest a few years back when I was in London showing... The Truth Is Out There, I think at Goldsmiths College. I was showing it all over the UK, and I showed it at Goldsmiths College. The host of Getting Better Acquainted came to that screening and then interviewed me later, and we had great fun. So it's my pleasure to finally welcome to the show Dave Pickering, storyteller.
Hello. Welcome. I'm glad to be here. I don't know why I'm welcoming you, but yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Yes, welcome, David, and thank you for welcoming us.
It's like the old Alan Partridge show, welcome me, welcome you.
Yeah, I'm clearly too used to being a podcast host and rather than a guest, so I'll have to get used to my newfound status.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, please.
Very good.
Please throw away that list of questions you prepared in advance.
Right. Yeah. Well, I've got some kind of some questions for you, which I guess the first one's going to be a bit kind of listeners to your podcast will have to bear with this one because they obviously probably know the answer already. I mean, first time listeners probably won't. But the first question is, who are you both giving me your name and a brief description of yourselves?
Wow. Okay. Go ahead, Phil.
We're going to
describe each other.
Let's do each other.
That's a cool idea.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. My co-host is Phil Lairness. He is a raconteur, filmmaker, storyteller, and violence prevention specialist in the city of Los Angeles.
And that's Dean Haglund. He's a classically trained improvisational comedian. He's a modern dance expert and aficionado. He is a fine, I don't mean as an adjective, I mean he's a fine artist. He's a very fine artist. He is a tour guide in Los Angeles. I don't know why I emphasize tour so much. He's a tour guide in Los Angeles, and maybe someday in Sydney, because it's really hard being a tour guide in Los Angeles when you live in Sydney, Australia.
That's really tricky.
And he is occasionally recognized for playing a computer hacking character on a beloved television series.
Yes, that's true. Though I've cut my hair, no one recognizes me anymore.
So when do we get to take over the show, Dave?
Well, I mean, you get to... I've got up to six questions, and then two bonus questions, and then after that, you can ask me whatever you like. So I guess the show starts with some questions about you, but then you can ask me anything you like for the remainder of our time together.
Well, that's so nice.
I like it.
That's so nice of you. This is what they describe as a hostile takeover, isn't it?
Yes. No, it's what we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Please.
Oh, I knew that the chickens would come home to roost on that.
Yeah, I mean, to explain to listeners to a certain extent why I'm asking you these questions is that I'm doing a new show coming out in the autumn, and you guys, this recording will be then used in as part of that show. So that's why I'm sort of it's two podcasts for the price of one. They get to hear this with us all together, and then later on they get to hear you guys edited a little bit and in a very, very different context, because that show is a fictional show. But yeah, you can ask me maybe about that later if you want to.
I thought your podcast would be called Two for the Price of One. That would have been a good show.
Yeah, but it's really not.
I would listen to that.
If it's the same conversation, Dean, it's one for the price of one, because you just get to listen to it again.
Oh, yeah, right. good point.
Right. So the second question I've got is, what is The Truth Is Out There, and why did you decide to make it? And I appreciate you guys are probably very bored of talking about the first show, film, so feel free to mention the second one.
Oh, very good.
Which is called The Truth Is Out There Too. So there's really, it's so much more exciting throwing the word two in after the name of it. Dean, why don't you talk about what The Truth Is Out There?
Well, let's see. This all started when you first came to a convention that I was at signing autographs, and you were you were taken aback. Would you be taken aback? You were amazed and shocked to hear all the stories that were that a lot of the fans and people would come up and tell me based on their experiences that were similar to storylines from The X-Files, be it UFO abductions or conspiracy theories or that sort of thing. And I never had any inkling that it was fascinating to anyone else, but Phil thought it was incredibly fascinating. And immediately jumped on the bandwagon, got a camera crew and financing together, and followed me around.
Not exactly.
The world.
No. He's cut several years out of this story. He's cut several years out. I did find that interesting. That was one part of it, and I really was fascinated by the way Dean could embrace all of this. Sometimes this really dark subject. Sometimes very personal stories that people, almost strangers, were sharing with him, and I was struck by how he could embrace these with his arms open wide, especially at a time when so many of us feel so inundated by information of any kind that we kind of need to hold up our hands in defense. So that was one inspiration. And then a couple years later, after I had finished making a movie called Karl Rove, I Love You, which was a comedy inspired by things that make me angry, I found myself angered by the way it didn't seem we could have any meaningful discussion about any public policy issue in this country without it devolving into competing conspiracy theories. And it's always easy to complain about stuff, but I enjoy trying to find out how something serves us, because everything serves us in some way. So I wondered, you know, how do conspiracy theories serve? And what does it mean to search for the truth? And what do you do when you've found it? And then I combined that with the inspiration of having witnessed Dean. And I thought, who better to follow into this world investigating it than someone so closely identified with conspiracy and the paranormal, and someone with the skills to be able to go into that world without judging people and instead appreciating them for the stories they had to tell.
So in 2009, he followed me around the world, and we had hundreds of hours of footage, and he cut it down to 2.5 hours. And that's the movie that is now called The Truth Is Out There.
And it really turned out to be, interestingly enough, an epic. It turned out to be an epic of not only conspiracy, but ultimately of consciousness and of comedy. Because the very skills set that make Dean an effective communicator through comedy are the exact same skills that make him such an engaging interviewer and able to set so many of his subjects. Because understandably, a lot of our interview subjects started off almost defensive because they've all been judged or they've all been misquoted or they've all been cut out of context. And Dean's skill set, that's, like I said, very part and parcel with the skills he uses as a comedian, as an improv comic, they all really immediately set these people at ease, and they realized, wow, not only are we not being judged, but we're being valued for more than just the information we have to offer. We're being valued for the personal story of how we got here.
Brilliant. For question counters listening, I may reduce some of the questions because some of them are being answered as we go. But the third question is, why are people drawn to conspiracy theories, do you think?
Good one. Let's see. Well, Phil, you take the first part.
Okay. Well, there is an interesting part in The Truth Is Out There where Dean is speaking with a renowned psychotherapist who makes the observation that creativity is a response and a healthy response to feelings of powerlessness. And as we live in a world where we feel at times so powerless, not just because of things involving the government, but things involving the way the world changes so fast, the information blizzard to which I referred, we feel so often so powerless, and so getting creative is a healthy response to this. And so many conspiracy theories are born out of this feeling of, wow, we were powerless to do anything about this thing that happened or is happening or is going to happen. So we're going to start researching it, and we're going to start finding out for ourselves what happened, and we're going to start telling that story to people. So that's the healthy end of it, and I think a lot of the attraction for it, because it suddenly makes all that we were feeling useful. The cautionary side of it is, and we met some of these people, how often the stories they author and the research they follow ends up plunging them into even greater feelings of powerlessness on the other side.
Right. That the truth is a rabbit hole that takes you down a dark hole, and it doesn't necessarily set you free. So it's a balancing act, for sure, to find both the dark and the light when you're investigating, particularly, you know, clandestine government actions or that sort of thing. It becomes hard on a psyche or two,
especially if you're so locked into it, into the mindset of the research, of the reality that you're investigating. But what we saw and what comes through loud and clear in Truth Is Out There is even the people with, let's say, the most pessimistic worldviews would express great hopefulness by the end of their interviews. And I gotta believe that an important part of that was because they simply enjoyed sitting down and interacting with Dean. And when you have an enjoyable human interaction and you feel seen and listened to and appreciated, suddenly there's a little more hope in the world than there was before.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things I really admire about that film. Do you believe there? Excuse me, I've got my throat is going, let alone the Skype line. Hang on a moment. I'm just going to have a sip of water.
Dave, you promised you wouldn't get so emotional.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
I mean, clearly there's something going. Maybe it's an extraterrestrial taking over my throat and stopping me from being able to ask this question. But yeah, do you believe people who say that they've had paranormal, supernatural, or extraterrestrial experiences?
Yeah, well, that's the big question. You know, what is your take on this? And, you know, there is 45,000 people in MUFON that all share a similar story and yet had no way of relating that. But at the same time, is that a Jungian psychological thing? So luckily, with my theater sports improv training, I have the ability to hold both the ability to believe and not believe at the same time, which sounds right. like a cop-out, but in fact is a way to approach every story so that you're not throwing out the baby with the bathwater. That there's, you know, even if there's seemingly someone who, many people who've seen it going, why do you allow these wing nuts the time of day to talk on your thing? At the same time, they have great information. So we actually have a segment in our Chilpack Hollywood called Wingnut of the Week for that very reason, that that someone who could be misconstrued and so dismissed by a large populace at the same time will have a nugget of wisdom that is so worth the journey to get there.
This spun off into several different topics. First of all, I must say that I believe at some point someone, and probably many people, used to literally throw out the baby with the bathwater, or else why would we have that phrase? That's a very odd phrase.
It's true.
But I think, Dave, the way you specifically phrased the question was most telling, because you asked whether we believe the people, not whether we believe the story that they're telling. And I have to say that almost always I believed the people. We know when someone is being authentic with us. We know when someone is being inauthentic with us. We have that in our body, in our makeup, in our intuition. We know. And if someone's being authentic with you and authentically sharing their truth, then I believe that belief is simply good manners. I would be rude not to believe them. And at the same time, I don't have to live my life according to their beliefs. I guess that's my version of what Dean said, believing and not believing at the same time. I'm not much interested, honestly, in what I believe. Although this is going to become, I guess, an important part of truth too, because it is a question that comes up again and again. I'm interested in the things I know, in the things you know, in the things that people know. And these are things that we have learned through experience, and they are truths that we embody. Getting back to the final point that Dean made, that I think is really, you know, if there's anything truly important in a movie like The Truth Is Out There, I think this is it. And Dave, you may remember when you came to Goldsmiths, I was under great fire. It was the first time I'd ever had an audience turn on me entirely because I had given freedom of speech to these people to express what I was suddenly hearing from an audience at Goldsmiths were dangerous ideas. And I couldn't argue with them that some of the things being said weren't dangerous. All I could say was, I know from my own history and from my country's history that when you do try to repress expression, it is always dangerous. At least when something gets expressed, we can form a relationship to it. But it's the unexpressed that eats away at things that ultimately will, if it's repressed long enough, seek expression, and usually at the wrong time in the wrong place. So it's a fascinating thing, but I have to fall on the side of letting people share what they believe is ultimately a healthy exercise. And when they feel like they're seen and listened to and appreciated, then you have the beginning of conversation.
Absolutely. I mean, that's so true. I think from my experiences of having conversations on mic with people, sometimes, and some of the people I've had on my show have thought and believed in conspiracies, or what other people might call conspiracies. They don't think of it that way, of course. The last question about that, about these kinds of things, because I recognize most of this is very well-trod territory for you. The last question is, what do you think about the representation of people with unusual, controversial beliefs in fiction, drama, and the media?
That one's for you, Dean.
That is a good one. Well, yeah, I mean, theoretically, I portrayed a mediated person with unusual beliefs. And at first, you know, we were called geeks, nerds, underground, like all sorts of, I guess there were diminutive terms, though we kind of wore them with pride, thinking that was cool, because that was the early days of the rise of the revenge of the nerds. So so the media has a way of a shorthand. It has to, because otherwise every story would be a 2.5-hour podcast just explaining the context of any single news item. So to go, oh, these guys are computer nerds, they're geeks in the X-Files, and that's a way to diminish the writing that displayed alternative viewpoints from FBI agents. So it made sense. You knew it had to be shorthand, but you can also see how that shorthand can undercut and ultimately diminish if you start just having that or knowing that to be the only truth, as it were.
Mm. Why not just focus on Dean's characters in the X-Files, the lone gunman? And let me tell you why I, as a fan, as an outsider, was moved by those characters, and why I think they're a great example of how you put these characters through their paces. And then, hopefully, by saying why I think they worked so well, it will answer the question of when I don't think similar themed characters work in other films and television shows. The Lone Gunmen were very easy shorthand for plot in the X-Files. They were used that way from time to time when things needed to get explained, needed to be explained in a believable way within the confines of that fictional world settings and rules. You could go to the gunmen, bring them in. This will get this information across, and not only will it get it across, it'll get it across in an entertaining way, which means that the audience will listen to it and grasp it. They won't be scratching their heads. We'll be entertaining them while we give them the plot info that they need. But that's not enough. The gunmen would not have become beloved characters if that's what they were alone, because indeed, that's not a real living human being. And when we watch movies and television shows, we only have so much patience for characters that are there only to service plot. Because story comes out of character, and character means recognizable human beings experiencing things that matter to them. And partly because of the casting, partly because of the chemistry, the performance of these actors, the writing, the directing, the lone gunmen transcended their function to plot, and they became nothing less than reminders to all of us that meaningful, long-lasting, lifelong-lasting friendships are forged on the basis of something as esoteric and ephemeral as searching for the truth.
Brilliant. Yeah, I mean that's a brilliant answer from both of you.
Thank you.
I've got two other questions that are kind of bonus questions, if you want them, or I can talk about my stuff with you guys, whatever you want at this point. Would you like the bonus question?
Your half of the show is not quite up yet, so why don't you give us your two bonus questions?
Right. So the first one is what does it mean to be human?
Wow. That's a good one. Do you ask all your guests that one?
Yeah. For this show, we are asking all of our guests these last two questions. Yeah. But I don't normally. So it's a new joyful experience throwing this at people.
Fantastic. Phil, do you want to start this?
All right, I'll start. To me, being human is to roll up your sleeves every day to set out on your primary responsibility, which is to find out what you're made of. It's to acknowledge that we are all but leaves from the tree of life falling, trying to describe that tree as we fall before we land and rejoin with the tree in our brief time.
Holy shit, you just bummed me out, Phil. Jesus. Holy crap.
It was pretty beautiful bumming out there.
Beautiful, yeah, I know. Eloquent.
Hey, Joseph Campbell said that.
Poetic.
Joseph Campbell said, right, all of life is sorrowful because everyone and everything in it we love will cease to be. So all of life is sorrowful. So then he was asked, well, then what's the trick? He said the trick is to joyfully participate in the sorrow.
Well, exactly. So that's my thing. And, you know, if you hold a belief in reincarnation, then the dying leaf and we all cease to exist thing kind of has some a solace attached to it. So it's not such a holy crap. I was a leaf briefly on the tree of life, and then I collapsed into mulch.
Although, of course, this is how Dr. Nicky Monty from Truth Is Out There addresses the concept of reincarnation. Right? It's either good news or it's more bad news, Dean. Because, as she said, no, the belief system is because we're beings of energy, and all of energy is made up of patterns. We are born into certain patterns, and we are stuck in the patterns lifetime after lifetime until we change our relationship to those patterns.
If you
don't believe in reincarnation, we are born into certain patterns, and we are stuck in those patterns year after year of our life until we change the relationship to them. So the only difference is, if this is the only go round, you better get around to changing those relationships now.
Oh, really? I can't wait another two lifetimes.
No, at some point, yes, this podcast will have to end.
Well, my being human is a little more, I don't know, fun? Fun? Is that the name? Mine is using all five senses to go in the world with an open arm and taking the skills, again, that you can learn in improv to listen and say yes to every suggestion and follow it wherever it may lead, and opportunities, and embrace things that you never thought you would be able to embrace because of your ability to say yes.
And mine is to train those senses so that they, those five senses, so that they can harmoniously coexist with the sixth sense of intuition.
God, look at you.
Wow. There's some amazing answers. I mean, what I like about being human is that every human gives a completely different answer to the question, what does it mean to be human? The last question I've got in front of me is, what is consciousness?
Wow.
Oh, well, I've always thought of consciousness as the awareness of our own awareness. Right.
I
just got out of teaching a 2-day acting intensive, and you know, even actors, it's amazing how often they forget that we are not the things we are feeling. Right. And they're playing characters, and they don't realize, you know, between takes or, you know, during breaks, they get an email that makes them feel a certain way, and they don't realize, wait a minute, I'm playing a character. I'm not what I'm feeling. And in fact, I might not even be the one feeling it right now. So what is consciousness then? It's being aware that I am feeling it.
Right. Wow. 'Cause this is the idea of consciousness. We know consciousness because it's the opposite of unconsciousness. So if you follow that, you see someone unconscious, you then you know that you are not that. It's sort of like being a Canadian and living very close to America. You don't really know what it is to be a Canadian, but you know you're not an American. So that's the metaphor, I think.
Okay, I'm going to let everyone at home just guess which one's conscious, which one's unconscious, the Canadian or the American.
What's with the one you're born with, I guess.
Yeah, although you never know. Maybe this is unconsciousness, and we will find consciousness when we die.
Oh, so this is slacker of life is a dream until you wake
well,
up.
I'm not. I think if I hope that if life was a dream, it would be a better one in some way. So yeah, I'm not so
too
tempted by that idea.
But
oh, no,
you know,
talking to you guys.
But there are plenty of opportunities where we do bump into the reality that this is a dream. We bump into the existence of the dreamer within us, mm-hmm. and it is a different perception than being in the dream. And so what am I saying? What I'm saying, I guess, is that I think what you just described, Dave, is a yes and. It's just a full shift into that awareness.
Absolutely. Right. Often in my dreams, I'm in the same city location, and I'll go down a street, and I'll look left, and there was a dream I had like 15 years ago that took place in that the dream. So the city, does it exist in a reality somewhere? Chances are it does, because it all seems to be mapping out over the years. And so is that the dreamer dreaming the dream? Or is the city existing as a dreamscape for, you know, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that old chestnut.
That old chestnut. You've heard it 1,000 times.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm done with my questions. We can now I can talk like an organic human being once again.
Wow.
It's a bit weird for me having a list of questions, because it's very much not like how I do Getting Better Acquainted, which is free form conversation. So yeah, this has been an interesting experience all round. I mean, I'm doing a podcast with two people in different parts of the world in different time zones, using a list in front of me. So yeah,
that is weird. How do you normally do it? Do you have guests come in and you chat with them?
I normally chat face to face. I like to see people's eyes and like body language and stuff like that. And also, I'm really interested in recording the room as well as the people. So I like to have background sound of where that room is and that moment in time I'm trying to capture.
I think that's brilliant. I always thought that was brilliant, because, you know, it's one of the things I teach again in this acting class, is reminding actors something that's so easy to forget when you're in an audition and it's basically a conference room, or even these days when you're on set, when so much of it is digitally created or is a place that you're setting foot on for the very first time, you know, reminding them, be affected by your surroundings, because the character has a relationship to this environment and you want to be affected by that no matter how imperceptibly, because we are, all of us, wherever we go, we are affected by that environment. So I always thought that that was a really interesting part. You know, Dean and I used to do every interview we did in person before he fled America by hot air balloon.
Right.
Leading up to the Donald Trump campaign. But
right, I saw it coming.
But you know, but we rarely went to people. We rarely went to people. We, of course, did, though, in The Truth Is Out There. We did think that in the movie, the settings, which were at least half the time picked by the interview subject themselves, unless they completely punted and said, anywhere you want me to be. But just where they would choose to feel most comfortable talking about these things would in and of itself say something about these people.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, and that's one of the things I like to do as well, is to talk to people in their homes or their personal personal spaces, like for that reason, or if they come to my house, that also has an effect on the way that the conversation goes and the moment happens. You know, I whether I'm the person having them into my space or them having me into their space, it kind of makes it more intimate and makes it more easier to connect in the conversation, I think.
So tell us a little bit about getting better acquainted. I was a guest, of course. I love listening to the show almost to the point, Dave, where at one point I got really kind of addicted to it, and then
that's cool.
And then something happened where I kind of got really bummed out because I thought I might never meet any of these people, and I sort of, you know, and it made me really sad. But how did it start? And I assume it's still going. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely still going.
Even with you launching a new show.
So I didn't catch that last time.
Even though you're launching a new show, you're still going to do the other one? You're going to do two shows at the same time?
Absolutely, I am. The new show is kind of a spin-off from Getting Better Acquainted. I'll answer the question about how and why I started Getting Better Acquainted, and then I guess I'll end it with the spin-off happening. So
look at that.
I made a terrible podcast for about a year of my life. Which started with me recording two of my oldest friends and me in a room for 4 days, and then trying to take all of that conversation and make it into a podcast. It was a terrible podcast. And it reminded me as well, I behaved like how I was when I was 15, and so did they. So it was kind of like three obnoxious people and me trying to make us less obnoxious for this whole year. And at the end of that year, I was kind of fed up of people hearing me only as this 15-year-old version of myself in a way. And I realized that when I talk to different people, I have very different conversations, and I was being defined by only one part of myself. So I decided to make a show about other people and my conversations with them. Part of it was as well, I sort of felt, having listened back to so much of myself, that I didn't listen to people enough. And I wanted to learn to listen better. And also I wanted to show different facets of who I was. So that's how it was, really. I record conversations with people I know, from my closest friends and family to someone I might have once met at a party, although it's got even more tangential than that. Sometimes it's people I only know through Twitter or whatever. The idea of acquaintanceship becomes enlarged and contracted all the time because it just changes. What that word means changes, and that's one of the fun things about doing the show. But yeah, I've had really personal conversations with, like, you know, my closest friends and family, and I've also had kind of much more wider conversations about people's ideas and thoughts and stuff. I guess it's completely and utterly changed me doing this for 5 years. I think in good ways. But yeah, it's definitely interesting to have that 5 years documented, so I can listen back to how terrible I was 5 years ago, and then 3 years ago I was a bit better, and then, you know, last week I'm maybe tolerable. So yeah, so that's been a great experience doing it. And it's kind of, it's opened up a lot of other doors, and I've done other shows as the result of that. But this show, The Family Tree, is a spin-off where I interview some people about a mystery. It's officially a fictional show, though, rather than a non-fiction, which is what Getting Better Acquainted is. But I'll leave that to listeners to decide when they hear the show. It's quite I can't say very much about it because there's a lot of spoilers. But I guess you could call it magical realist.
Wow, sounds intriguing.
And it's kind of about a family. Yeah, it's a family drama in a way. But that's kind of all I can really say at this stage. But in the autumn, we're launching it for 12 weeks. One episode a week will be investigating the mystery, and then we'll have an extra episode where I talk about issues that are raised in the mystery with experts like yourself. And now this has got very meta because that's why
it sure has. Wow, that sounds intriguing. Now, do you have a writing background?
Well, I know I have a theatre background. I and writing too. I mean, I've written fiction, I've written poetry, I've written plays, and all sorts of things like that. I studied theatre and creative writing at university, although I'm not too sure if I think it's very much worth studying creative writing in many ways. But I wanted an excuse to write and have that be counted towards my degree, because I knew I'd be writing anyway.
Which university?
I went to Lancaster University in the UK. And so I studied that, and I wrote stuff and tried to like make it as a writer for quite a few years after that. And then I moved to London in order to connect with the performance scene, because I hadn't performed for a long time. I've done all sorts of things when I've been here. I've sort of set up bands and I've set up nights and I've done various different things. But over time, weirdly, I've become more and more known for nonfiction, for true storytelling. I run a true storytelling night as part of Spark True Storytelling. That's got a podcast as well. It's a bit like The Moth, really, but it's a bit more raw than The Moth, and it's a bit more like everyday people than The Moth, because I don't mean to criticize The Moth, but The Moth has much more kind of people who are writers or have a background in the arts, and Spark has just everyday people, which is, you know, not to say artists and writers aren't everyday people and everyday people aren't also artists and writers and creators.
They're trained.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, and it's nice to have sort of untrained people in some ways, particularly because it's kind of, it becomes an opening up space. It's kind of a little bit about the truth is out there in some ways, in that people get up on stage and they tell their truth.
Right.
Well, and everybody else has to listen and respond. And then you find in the breaks, nobody has those awkward conversations, small talk. Everyone is just talking about like their child. Bereavement and everything, you know. It's great.
Absolutely.
It's a wild night. Are
you still running those nights?
I do them at the Hackney Attic in London on the second Monday of every month, and Spark does a few other nights in London that I'm kind of involved with producing too. And also, I guess the other thing I do that is kind of note, I guess, is I run a night called Stand Up Tragedy, which is kind of takes the kind of Phil Lernis approach to life in terms of human beings from his description, and looks at the reality of death and bereavement and tragedy, and looks at the tragic form as well. It kind of takes tragedy as a very wide thing. So you can have Greek tragedy, or you can have, you know, personal accounts, and it's kind of comedy, storytelling, spoken word, mixing it all up. Any kind of tragedy is
wonderful. And it's
goodness, I never thought.
Stand up?
I never thought that I could describe myself as a stand-up tragedian.
Yeah, stand-up tragedian.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, absolutely. And yes, a lot of stand-ups do the night. I mean, for comedians, it's a great opportunity to play it straight. But it's also those are sometimes some of the most moving performances, I think, when someone who's got the skills to be funny suddenly allows himself to be sad. It's a kind of profound moment, I think, in a lot of ways.
Oh, wow. That sounds great. Love to see that, too.
But, yeah. So yeah, I do that, and then I guess the last thing, if in the roll call of things I'm getting associated with these days, is I made a solo show last year about being a man, a true storytelling show called What About the Men, mansplaining masculinity.co.uk that's how you find it. In fact, all my stuff, if you look at it, it's all .co.uk, people listening, because it's cheaper to get .co.uk, that's why I have it. And I'm from the UK. That show looked at what it is to be a man, looking at the bad things that happen to men in society, but also the bad things that men do as a result, I think, in many ways, of being framed as men in society. So it's kind of looking at my own life, interrogating things that have happened to me and things that I've done to other people, but also kind of looking wider at the internet, kind of, and feminist theory and different things like that. It's interesting, actually. I've come across people who have accused me of being a conspiracy theorist doing that show, because a lot of people on the extreme end of kind of the manosphere, as they call it, the pushback against feminism, they say that the word patriarchy is a conspiracy. It proves that I'm a conspiracy theorist, and I've got to open up my eyes to the reality of that we live in a female supremacy, they tell me.
What?
So I've definitely... the experience, the position now of being cast as a conspiracy theorist. So that gives me more sympathy with conspiracy theories.
Oh my God!
In some way,
I gotta say the equivalent of that would be someone who believes in, you know, advanced extraterrestrial life visiting this planet. If you were to respond to them with, okay, I'm willing to believe you, but where's the science? Where's the science? And if they then said to you, oh, see, you're a subject of that whole scientific conspiracy theory. Right.
Right. Well, that's an interesting thing as well. I did a survey of 1,000 men anonymously over the internet to get their opinions about the word patriarchy and about being a man and things that have happened to them and stuff like that. And I deliberately didn't frame that as rational or scientific. I'm not interested in rational or scientific. To me, that's part of the problem in some ways of the way that men are framed. We're supposed to all be logical, but we're all feeling emotions all the time. And so it's absurd to claim that we're acting logically or objectively as we're so often seen in the media, or, you know, it's always men are the logical people and women are just being emotional. And that's so not true compared to my life. I'm too emotional all the time. I'd like to be less emotional in some ways. But then I think that wanting to be less emotional is part of the fact that I've been told I shouldn't be emotional because I'm a man in some ways.
But, absolutely. Yeah. And what do you learn in theater school but how to connect to your emotions? I mean, that is
right.
The basic part of the whole acting thing. So you've trained yourself specifically to be connected to your emotions, and then you go through the rest of the society going, oh, you shouldn't really have done that.
Well, and you and Dave just kind of referenced and rephrased what I said to that Goldsmiths audience, right? I mean, he just put it in a nutshell about masculinity. If you repress because society tells you that you're supposed to, your emotions, you're not supposed to show them. When you do express them, you tend to express them in an all too volatile.
Absolutely. And that's what we see now so frequently from men, bottling up their emotions so much and then committing acts of violence. I mean, you know, not just the everyday violence that happens to women, you know, in domestic violence terms, but also these kind of specifically ideologically aimed acts of violence that are framed within masculinity, framed as being about, I mean, there's been a terrible one just very, very, very recently in your country, which for what any other things you can say it's about. One of the things it's about is about masculinity trying to police other men. That's what, you know, homophobia is. And I'm not gay, but growing up, I experienced a lot of homophobia. And so I'm very raw at this moment in solidarity. And I think, you know, I hope everybody is. But I think that it is absolutely the way we treat men that causes those kind of violent outbursts. And if we learn to talk about our emotions, we wouldn't act in this extremist kind of violent way.
That's amazing because, you know, one of the things that I always fear, speaking about conspiracy theories, is how quickly, and now in mainstream politics, it's not just, you know, on the fringe, people are going to concoct their own conspiracy theories around what really happened at this tragedy. And why I always now kind of clench about that is I feel like it comes so quickly that it's just unpardonably distasteful while we're still counting the dead, you know? And but what you've done is you've framed the incident in a way that the analysis bears fruit regardless of who did it.
Right. Right, because we did it. At the end of the
day, we did it.
Human beings did it, right? And that's the first thing you know about anything that happens. Human beings die and human beings cause that death. And then we've got to work out what we do to limit that happening in the future. You know, I mean, for example, I mean, I don't know that prisons do that. I don't think that the prison system limits the amount of violence that happens. I think that there are different ways we could treat men, often men, because men mostly commit and are arrested for violent crime. And, you know, if you're a man of color, you're most likely to be arrested for non-violent crimes around drugs or whatever. But you still, we put men in prisons and then they come out even more violent. And the thing is, that what we need to do is think, how do we stop men from being violent? And also not just men, because something I do try to make clear in my show, I mean, I had a violent mother. I've had experience of emotional violence from women as well as from men, and physical violence from women as well as from men. And the, you know, young boys are often brought up by women who teach them how to be a man, and they teach them very bad rules sometimes. So it's not just men who are to blame for men, but it's all of us who are to blame for men. But it is men that are the problem, and we need to sort of try and tease that out and heal men. I'd like to be healed, certainly. And I think that there's lots of men who, underneath all of the fear of being vulnerable, would like to be healed too, you know?
Well, if nothing else, for the love of God, we've got to stop having those babies thrown out with the bathwater.
Right.
So, Dave, people are probably understanding now already why I say that you lead with the word storyteller when introducing Dave Pickering. The thing is, you lead with the word storyteller because at some point, and it wasn't by design, right? At some point, you recognized that all your many activities in life, the ones you've mentioned, but so many others, all of them revolved around the importance of storytelling.
Right. I mean, that's the difficult thing when you make music and you write fiction and you do documentary and you do all sorts of different things. Like, what do you say you are? People want a one word answer. And so to a certain extent, it was like, what's the umbrella term? And yes, storytelling. I think originally I had something like journey person, I take people on journeys. But at the same time, I think storytelling is more clear. I mean, I think storytelling does mean taking someone on a journey in whatever. In whatever kind of journey that is. I think that a good story starts in one place and ends in another, right? So it is about journeys. But yeah, I discovered that, yes, that is the umbrella term. And I was employed as a storyteller, literally. I was I was working with the under fives doing story and song times, like telling telling picture books and doing nursery rhymes and sort of nursery stories with my ukulele and my puppets and stuff like that, which in this country at that time, was something that the council provided. I was going into council-funded centres for children's services, which people from deprived areas and from rich areas, whatever, could go and use for free and get kind of access to education for their young children and all sorts of things like help with how to budget their houses or that stuff and benefits and stuff like that. So it was a great things that we had in this country at that time, and I sort of delivered these stories and song times. And then I don't know what you know about UK government, but we've been cutting back on the welfare state for quite a long time in this country, to the point where I'd say we probably don't have it anymore. Like, I know a lot of Americans who come here going, you've got the best system in the world, the welfare state, and I'm like, I'm sorry, we don't have it anymore, you came too late. But what's happened is that those have been cut, all of those services. And so my service was cut, and I had this decision. Do I want to go back to doing a longer full-time job that I didn't want to do, that I didn't like doing, in a service that might also be cut? Or did I go freelance? And I decided to go freelance. It's been a roller coaster of a nightmare of a ride. I pretty much make rent most times, but it's touch and go. But when I decided to become that freelance person, I had to find a thing to sell people. I had to have a brand. And so Storyteller was the name, the word I came up with for my website. You know, Dave Pickering Storyteller.co.uk is the website. And that was like the thing that I could find to try and sell to people. But it doesn't work that way, because you find the one word and then you tell that word to someone and they look at you blankly, and then you have to do the paragraph about all the other things you do to explain what storyteller means. So
that's why, I've fallen back on artist, just, you know, as opposed to actor, painter, right, entrepreneur, all of that. You just go, hey, man, I'm an artist. And then that's,
I mean, artist is definitely what I am. I am an artist, and I'm not afraid to use the word art or artist, which a lot of artists are, weirdly. Particularly the ones who don't work in the kind of high arts or high culture or whatever, people who work in what we like to unnecessarily call low culture often don't want to use the word art or artist about themselves. But
right.
I mean, at the same time, it does give people the implication that I'm going to be able to do visual, like
exactly.
fine art. Like
yeah,
right. Yeah,
do,
yeah. Draw a
and
picture.
I don't.
That's yeah.
The one art I can't really do is that.
Well,
I think my brother's got the art skills. He does the painting.
I think yeah. storytelling it invites storytelling invites further conversation. It invites follow-up questions.
Right.
Whereas, like, you're right, some people could just make assumptions about what you mean by artist. Just like, quite honestly, I'm glad you didn't, when you were working with the under fives, I'm glad you didn't bill yourself as a Journeys person, because I might have been scared that you were giving ayahuasca to the kids.
Right, I mean, it's... Well, when I worked with the under fives, I never gave any impression that I had ever taken any kind of substance. In fact, I was doing Getting Better Acquainted at the time, and I had to be very careful what I said, because when you work for the council in this country, you sign a bit of paper that says you can't say anything about the council, and you can't say anything that will bring the council into disrepute. So I had to censor myself, and now I'm freelance. I'm free to say if I was taking ayahuasca with the kids.
In your face, council. We're out of time. And it's been a delight, Dave.
A delight.
I hope our paths will cross again in face to face rather than Facebook to Facebook, as I like to say, on your fair shores or here at some point in the near future.
Absolutely.
Or here, yeah, that'd be, Sydney, Australia.
Yeah, all absolutely. Two potential countries to bump into two different people who, yeah, that's always great. I never leave this country because I haven't got any money, but one day maybe I will be in one of your two countries.
Fantastic.
Or you'll be in mine.
All right. Dave Pickering again.
Thanks very much.
It's dave.pickering.storytelling.co.uk. What is the website?
Yeah, Dave Pickering, storyteller.co.uk, standuptragedy.co.uk, gettingbetteracquainted.co.uk, Spark is the odd one out, stories.co.uk, and then the familytreepodcast.co.uk has some teasers up already and will be coming much more active in the September this year.
All right.
Fantastic.
Dave Pickering,
thanks
ladies
so much,
and gentlemen,
Dave.
Thanks so much.
Thanks
be
so
well.
Much.
Guests of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.